Okay, here we are. Today I'm welcoming onto Radio Gorgeous an author who divides her time between the UK and Greece. In fact, it was her first book about Greece, The Island, about an abandoned leprosy colony, which brought her great success. She is Victoria Hislop, and we're talking about her latest sixth book, Carte Postale from Greece. Hi, Victoria. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Hello. Lovely to be with you.
So, Victoria, why is this book different than most adult books out there?
Well, in a word, I felt that children were having all the fun. Because when you're little, your books are illustrations with a few words. And over the subsequent decade, the pictures shrink and you're just left with words. And I love words, obviously. I mean, it's my stock in trade. But I still believe that adults quite like looking at something visual. So I decided that I wanted to do a work of fiction, because obviously non-fiction, packed with photos, but very rarely in fiction. So I decided I wanted to do a book which had loads of photographs of Greece, because it's a very photogenic country. It almost goes without saying. And I wanted to show not just beautiful things, because we're all familiar with picture postcard images of harbours and little churches and you know, beautiful seascapes, but I also wanted to show some of the slightly darker, tattier things that you see in Greece. There's a real mixture of pictures mixed in with the stories.
I'm intrigued to know, because apparently you always, in your, when you're working, you surround your walls with pictures.
Mm.
So you went with the photographer to Greece. Can you tell us kind of how it all happened?
Sure. I mean, the pictures that I've always taken for myself when I'm researching in the past were good enough for me in terms of just giving me inspiration. But for really high quality reproduction, that's a whole different league of photography. So I knew I would have to work with somebody else. And I picked somebody who I knew would also tell me a lot about the history and culture of Greece as we travelled. So, you know, his role was to take the visual images, but also when I saw something quirky and odd and strange, and there are many such things in this book, I was able to say, you know, what is this? Why is this happening? And one example was turning up in a little seaside town at the beginning of January. And in fact, the thing that had taken me there was a huge ancient Roman site very close to this town where we ended up. And the Roman site itself wasn't, for me, particularly inspiring. But the thing that was happening in this little town was extraordinary. And that was that on the 6th of January every year, and this happens all around Greece, anywhere where there's water, either on the coast or if there's a lake, it will happen in a lake, that the local priest throws a cross into the water. And although it sounds mad for a sort of January activity, the fit young men of the town will throw themselves into the water and try and be the first one to find the cross, which will have sunk to the bottom of the sea.
Yeah, how big's the cross?
Well, the one I saw being thrown in was about 10 centimetres. So it wasn't huge, and it's not particularly heavy, but it sinks. And it's an extraordinary thing to see. And if I'd been there on my own, I would have thought, what's this swimming gala going on? What's the story of this? Why do people do it? And what does it result in? And the kind of whole story of it is something that's retold in Carte Postale.
So what it is each chapter, it's a really good bedtime read, because I read a chapter a night.
Oh, that's nice.
You know, and then good. You're sort of dropping off, but I finished it, because they're not too long. But also you move from, you know, they're not all 21st century at all. You move in time, don't you?
Yes, I mean, the format of the book is that a broken-hearted man, an Englishman, is travelling around Greece. And the reason that he's specifically on this journey is that the woman who he was meant to meet hasn't shown up. and she's broken his heart. And he's faced with, I think, what's probably quite a common dilemma for everybody when they're dumped, is that they can't bear other people's pity. And he's a proud man, and he knows that he's been waiting in Greece, that's why he's in Greece. But he knows if he goes back to London, all his friends will say, oh, I'm so sorry to hear about your split. And they'll start introducing him to other women, and they'll expect him to pull himself together in a week or so. But he is devastated, and he cannot face that kind of activity that he knows that will go on around him. And also, he fears that he'll see this woman in the street. And he also fears that he'll think he sees her in the street. You know, every street, he'll imagine that it's her. So he thinks if he stays in Greece, it'll give him some time to put his life back together.
So he reflects on each story afterwards.
He does. These are stories that are told to him in every village, town that he goes to. People talk to him. All total strangers to him. But as you know, because you go to Greece like I do, there's no such thing as a stranger. I mean, this hospitality that seems to kind of run through the veins of most Greek people is all based on the idea that they think you might be a god in disguise. That's philosophically where it comes from. And so he enjoys a kind of brief friendships with lots of different people, and each chapter of the book is something that he's been told. And as he travels, as he listens, all these things kind of rebuild him. And at the beginning, he hears stories that almost reflect his own
devastation,
anger. Yeah. He hears a story about a man who was stood up at the altar. He hears a sort of story about revenge. And as he travels, the stories become slightly more optimistic, or these are the ones that he writes in his diary that's eventually sent back to England. And by the end of it, you know, he has a desire to live, which at the beginning I don't really think he does. He's sort of looking out at the sea, and I think he would have happily thrown himself in. And at the end, he's much happier.
Now, you touched on Greece. Tell us, don't you own a villa in Greece? Is that how it all started, or did you go to Greece even before that?
No, owning the villa was kind of almost the end, not the end of the story, but it's the current bit of the story. But I've been going to Greece every year since I was 17. My first visit was with my mother, and we were
Where did you go?
Well, we went to Athens.
Wow, that was quite unusual then.
It was a bit, wasn't it?
Yeah, because Athens was seen as quite a scary place.
It was, but it was. And I remember feeling kind of amazed by it, but never afraid, because, you know, I knew which side of the road that the cars drove on. But it was very chaotic then. Mm. This was back in the late 70s, you know, before there was an underground system, a metro. It was very dusty. I don't remember the street signs being transliterated into English sort of letters that I could recognise. Mm. So it was very chaotic, but I rather loved it. And I loved the heat. And it was July, so it was probably about 100 Fahrenheit. And then we went to Paros, which is one of the Cycladic islands, and so beautiful. It was a revelation to me, really, because I hadn't, until I think I'd been once to Malta and once to Spain, so we hadn't travelled as a family. We'd always had, you know, I'm not going to pretend they were wonderful holidays that I had as a child. I was always cold and lying on a beach, sitting on a beach, eating, you know, sandwiches with sand in, you know, that gritty thing that happens when you crunch into a sandwich on Bognor Regis beach. And that's where we went, Bognor Regis. And to go from Bognor Regis to Paros, there are no words. That's where you run out of words. That's where pictures would be good. Yeah. Bognor Regis, the colour of the sea, Paros, you know, is that still called sea? I was amazed. I mean, really, truly astonished by it. And I loved it, in short. interestingly, I have a sister who I think to this day would prefer the Sussex beach to the Greek beach. You know, it's not to everybody's taste, but that was the beginning.
So do you speak Greek? Because there's a lot of Greek, I mean, I don't want to put people off, but you kind of use Greek expressions and you always translate them. But, you know, there is Greek in the book. Can you speak it?
Yes, I started learning probably about 7 years ago, very intensively.
How intensively?
Well, I went to the Hellenic Centre in London, where they have many...
Well, you had your book launch.
Yes, yeah. Where I had my book launch. And they do language lessons. But I had a teacher twice a week, one-to-one,
wow,
for about 2 hours each lesson, so 4 hours.
Was that kind of talking or writing down, or was it just chatting?
It was both, yes. It was a structured language course. And...
And did you find the intensiveness was good, do you think?
Definitely.
Yeah.
I'm not... I genuinely don't think that you can learn a language in a class of 10 people.
Ah.
Sorry, even class teachers. But if you really want to get to a stage of fluency where you can go to the country and talk about whatever you want to talk about, anything you want to talk about, it's going to be very difficult.
And can you talk now to people?
Or could,
you know, you're better than restaurant Italian.
I think restaurant Greek. I think if we were doing this now, I would be doing it in Greek in Greece. So I do my sort of radio.
This is amazing.
But it's a challenge.
I think
there's a self-help book. and people laugh about self-help
books.
Yeah, they do. Except I don't, because... Mm. In most self-help books, there's one thing
that you can latch
onto. Just go, wow,
if
that's the one thing I take away. And there's a brilliant one called Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. But I think she's called Susan Jeffries.
It's one of the most seminal books.
It is.
Yeah.
And for me, in fact, I read it because I was writing a self-help book. So I was buying self-help books and reading them. And she says... It's all in the title. You don't actually need to go further than that. Feel the fear and do it anyway. And going on live Greek television, I feel fear, but I do it anyway. And every time I do it, I get better at Greek because I kind of swallow some of the fear and there's a word that I learn and next time it's easier.
So are you famous in Greece?
I'd say I'm well known,
amazing.
And I get recognised.
That's amazing, because you didn't set out to do this at all,
no,
I imagine.
No, definitely not. And I'd hate to be famous in England, but because there's so many people here.
Yeah.
But in Greece, I get recognised
so
in the street.
All your books are translated into Greek, obviously.
Yeah, they are.
And they adore them.
They like them so far. I don't know what they'll make of Carte Postale, because it has some slightly darker things. I'm not uncritical, because in The Voice of Antony, who's the English protagonist, he has various conversations with people where he reveals certain things that are not so far away from my own reactions to certain things that happen in Greece. And so they might not like that, because they'll see that I don't have this kind of completely rosy view.
Also, but you're
Greece.
Not Greek, you see, so
yes.
You can stand back and do that.
I can.
Yeah.
As an outsider, I think you see things that they stop seeing, and you sometimes find yourself expressing things that they don't feel comfortable to express.
I think the thing I picked up most from your book is the passion they have compared to us. Would you say that's true?
I think so. I mean, I don't think it's passion that's just in Greece. I think everybody who goes to Italy and Spain sees that same kind of slightly deeper vein of passion that Northern Europeans don't tend to have. There's a downside to it. You know, passion can mean anger as well as love passion. It can mean fury as well. So, you know, we live more calmly here. and we don't we're meant to. Yes. We try and yeah, live more calmly.
but they, like, you know, there's revenge, things like that. Like, that's kind of more accepted in their culture.
Yes, it is. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I'm told that in Crete, which is the island where we have our house, that there are still some vendettas that are still being played out, you know, and these, some vendettas, I hear, you know, dozens of people were killed during the 20th century because of vendetta. And it's a kind of recognised form of revenge, if you like. You know, one sort of imagines it's fictional, but it's not. You know, there really are still, you know, people who will be out to kill somebody who's done something bad to a member of their family. So, you know, not very often. I'm not saying this is a common thing, but it is not unknown, and it's definitely within living memory of older people that vendettas were quite a normal thing.
Now, I must bring in, because I'm wearing it round my neck, I went to Greece on holiday this summer, and I've got the evil eye. Oh. Well, I hope it's stopping the evil
it's
eye.
It's stopping
not
the evil.
It.
It's stopping now, that's
I've
beautiful.
I've always wanted to know about the evil eye, because I've been going to Greece for a long time like you, and I want it's in the Byron story, which is amazing, but I want you to explain about the evil eye and you know, its relevance today.
Yeah. Well, in Greece they call it the mati, which just simply means the eye. And I prefer to think of it as the protecting eye, because when you say evil eye, it sounds like the eye is being evil, but it's obviously protecting you from you. It's like an eye looking back at an evil eye. And one of the things that is so, I mean, again, it seems so strange to an English person that if somebody compliments you in Greece, you spit, because it's a bad thing to be complimented, because it might mean that a spell is cast on you. If somebody's saying that you look nice, actually it's kind of opening this sort of door to jealousy and evil. And jealousy is a very powerful force in Greece, and I've often felt it myself. And for example, a baby, if you go to a christening in Greece, and they're huge events, you know, you invite your closest 500 friends, and during the course of the day, every single person there will be given a little tiny pin with one of those, much smaller version of the one that you're wearing, a little tiny weeny eye. And it will also be pinned to the baby, which I always find kind of alarming. You know, you've got a sort of six-month baby waving its arms around. There's a sort of socking great safety pin with a little eye. And that's because when a child is very young, again, it's very vulnerable to this sort of negative forces of other people's jealousy and ill will. So it's quite, I think it's, what I find interesting, it is like an acceptance that there is this thing of people saying you look lovely, and I think women know they do this sometimes. Oh, you do look lovely, and they mean it, but there's a bit of jealousy in it. If you see your best friend looking absolutely drop-dead gorgeous, and you're going out together, yeah, and you're thinking, well, you look lovely, but in your mind, in the sort of little the dots
but I,
of
but
the bubble,
I'm not.
No, you're saying, and you look, in brackets, you look nicer than me. Yeah. So there is this kind of acknowledgement that other people's beauty or good fortune can be slightly kind of annoying to oneself, which I, you know, I think that's quite realistic and real.
It's kind of like it's protecting your psyche, isn't it?
Yes,
really? It's
saying
it's to do with your, because you know, as we know, mental thoughts can affect people. Mm. So it's sort of, it's like a barrier of psychic badness coming to you. Really,
absolutely.
It
is quite, you know, a modern thing as well. I think
really?
We can see this. Well, we can see that thread in, I mean, I think other people's bad thoughts about you. Somebody very pragmatic might say, well, don't be ridiculous. Why would somebody over there on the other side of the room having negative thoughts about you, how can that have any effect? You know, don't be absurd. That's just airy-fairy stuff. Mm. But I think they can. Mm. You know, that's just me thinking they can, maybe. But I don't think I'm alone. But the Greek kind of culture, and in fact it's a Middle East thing generally, acknowledges that you do need protection from other people's thoughts. And in Greece, if you're felt to be under the actually of being badly affected by somebody else's negative thoughts about you. You can have the eye cast out. You know, that can be in villages still in Crete.
Is it like a ritual then?
Yes, it's a little ritual. I think, I can't remember exactly because I've never had to have it done. But it involves putting a drop of oil into water or water into oil, one of the two, to see if they mix, to see if the eye actually has affected you. And then they do various things, I think chanting or something, to get rid of the eye. So it's quite a sort of real thing. But there are, I think, and you see them hanging up in every house. You know, I'm never without one somewhere. In my bag I have, and I don't always wear one. But I am thinking of getting a tattoo so that I'm never without the eye.
I love it. You're one of the first people to come onto Radio Gorgeous and tell me, and you're not young, like, you're going to have a tat. That's bloody cool.
But David Dimbleby's got a big one, hasn't he? He's got a scorpion.
Dread to think where. He was rather naughty with me once. He once slapped my bottom at a lunch, quite recently.
Really? Oh, yeah, well, ask him about his tattoo.
So how excited are you about this book coming out? Because it is a different one, Victoria. Are you doing a bit of Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway then?
Yes, definitely. Definitely that's in practice with this book, because I had to feel the fear and do it anyway when I came to see my publisher about it, to say, how about putting 100 colour photos in the work of fiction? And I thought, what will they say? How ridiculous does that sound? But I showed them some of the pictures that had already been taken and they said yes. And nobody to date said, that is a really stupid thing to do. Definitely not buying that. Because I think everybody's pleasure is enhanced, you know, if there's something lovely to look at in a book. So I'm feeling less fear as time goes on, and slight sort of fear, not fear, but a little bit of trepidation about the fact that my next book probably won't have photographs. You know, I have to go back.
Yeah, what will you cling on to?
To filling more pages with words and not kind of interspersing with photos.
But also it might make you think differently, and that's what creative process is, isn't it? It's always turning things on your head.
I think so, and doing things differently, doing new things. I mean, it's only, 10 years ago that I wrote my first book. I'm 57 now. So at the age of, 46, 47, I did something completely different. And I always think, well, maybe it's time to do something else different. You know, I'll become an acrobat or something, maybe.
Okay, a tattooed acrobat.
Now we're talking. It would be worth having the tattoos.
It would.
And
I'll definitely give you another interview. Victoria Hislop, thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous and talking about Carpo Style. And it's published by Headline. Thank you so much. You've been a brilliant fun guest.
Thank you so much for having me. Wouldn't that be
really
fun?
Good.
You see, you haven't always done what you're doing now, have you?
God,
what did you do before?
I was a performer, cabaret singer. That's how I met James.
God.
I mean, this is the most kind of... Okay, all right, well, look, I'll just... Mm.